Welcome everybody to the podcast. This is Unsolicited Advice with J.R. Bennett
and Ryan Witkowski.
Welcome everybody. I'm J.R. Bennett. I realized in our last podcast we didn't take the time to introduce ourselves, so we'll take a couple seconds to introduce ourselves. Like I said, I'm J.R. Bennett. I'm a marriage and family therapist intern in the Bay Area, and I work with children and adolescents, mainly young adults transitioning into adulthood is my area of expertise.
Okay. What does an intern mean exactly?
That means that I have graduated from my marriage and family therapy program, and currently I'm gathering hours of experience toward licensure.
So you have a master's degree?
I do have a master's degree. Yeah. Okay. So
I knew that. I'm just saying that. Yeah. Okay. I actually went to school with JR. We spent at least a portion of our program together. Did some of the training together, and I completed the program. I haven't yet got my master's degree. I work primarily now as a health coach, which is, I don't even know if you know this entirely, but I work as a health coach for the most part. I do, so basically that's behavior change around lifestyle change, stress management, nutrition, sleep hygiene, and exercise. I also do personal training. Mm-hmm. I work with a wide variety of people on joint mobility.
Is it okay to say where you work?
University of California, Berkeley.
Okay.
And also, I do post-physical therapy exercise for people transitioning out of an injury from physical therapy and onwards. So that's kind of what I do right now. I like to incorporate kind of my knowledge in psychology into the health field. And, eventually I will go forth and get my license.
But very good. We'll and just to clarify, you do have your master's degree. You're not registered yet.
Yeah, I have my master's degree. Okay. And the process in California is very complicated as far as people actually getting the ability to be a licensed mental health professional, which I think is a good thing. You know, you don't want it to be too easy. You don't want to pay $100 and next thing you know you're providing therapy to people.
Right.
That would be bad. So we were talking about earlier before we had came on about what we were going to talk about. And last week we had mentioned that we wanted this podcast to be about change.
Right.
And so we figured we'd start off and JR was going to talk a little bit about kind of what it's been like for the last week with him as far as reflecting back on starting the podcast and also whatever's been going on with him.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, I see this as being part of the podcast. I mean, since we do have kind of a theme with change going on that I would talk kind of candidly about the changes that I'm going through, the changes that I'm trying to make in my life. So over the last week, I decided to take a massive online open course, which is known as a MOOC, which is pretty cool. It's this one's offered through Harvard, and it's awesome. You can take it online for free. So you get to take a Harvard class online at no cost, mm-hmm. which is pretty awesome.
What's the website?
This website is, it's edx.org.
Okay.
And I guess there's a few different websites that you can get these from.
Yeah.
So that was the first one I found that was really easy to hook up with, so I went with them. The class I chose is a computer science class, which is way out of my area of expertise. I know very little. I'm hardly computer literate. I know enough to get through life, and I've never taken the time to really understand more. So, I mean, it's such a big part of our lives, I figured it could be pretty interesting. So I decided to take that class, and plus I could start that class right away. Some other classes you have to wait for.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to jump into it. The part that I thought would be interesting for the podcast was kind of the inner process that I was going through as I was making this change. And I remember that when I set out to take this class, the purpose for making the change was to, you know, keep learning and keep developing as a person and finding new passions and areas of interest in life.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that as I kept moving forward, I started to think about, you know, how I could use this new knowledge to make money. Or, you know,
as a computer scientist.
As a computer scientist, right? Or how I could, you know, kind of turn this new thing into a commodity of some kind. You know, how it could, like, improve my life in some other way other than how I had intended.
And your intention was just to have fun with it.
Exactly.
To gain a new skill.
Yeah.
As a hobby or area for growth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I noticed that, I guess I didn't really notice that until I realized that I was kind of feeling a lot of anxiety around doing the next session of the class. And I was wondering, where is this anxiety coming from? And really thinking about what I was thinking, I realized, you know, where it was coming from. It's all these thoughts of, you know, trying to make money. It was really the pressure of my future. I placed the pressure of my future on this class, just taking this online class. So
right.
I really had to bring myself back down to reality and remind myself, this is for fun. Just enjoy this.
Do you equate meaningfulness with financial gain? Has that been a thing for you in the past?
I think it's really difficult, absolutely, in our society to not get wrapped up in the rat race and to not equate, you know, the value of yourself with the status that you've achieved or the money that you can make and the things that you can buy. And also, I think that especially with money, you know, we have a desire for security in life. It feels good to not have to worry about where, you know, your next meal is coming from. And I'm not that destitute, but there's this importance placed on money. And I think that it's easy to forget that we only need really so much to feel okay about our lives and feel secure, you know. So I'd say it's a natural tendency, or not maybe not a natural tendency, but it's become a tendency to look at things through that filter.
To equate, I would even say, you know, I'm just thinking about this as you're talking, but the acquisition of money to a point is almost an addiction of some sorts. I think people get addicted to the idea of money equaling a lot more than it really is. People will try to have money replace general happiness, relationship. Someone has a poor relationship with their partner, their wife, their husband. Usually the partners will start, maybe the husband will start work, spending longer hours at work.
Right.
You know what I mean? Trying to just, if I get more money, everything's going to be okay. The security blanket.
Yeah, and where is that finish line?
There is no finish line.
Right.
There is no finish line. And it becomes a detriment to him, the person who's chasing the money. People will do some pretty crazy things to get money in all kind of aspects. But go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems like it's easy to set out with a pure intention. Like maybe, you know, that that guy, that hypothetical person you just mentioned, is going to work and working really hard to make the money to provide for his family so he and his wife can have a better house and they can be, you know, in his mind, happier together. Like, that's the ticket. But along the way, through trying to achieve that goal, he could end up damaging his relationship.
And I won't even make this hypothetical. I mean, I've been guilty in the past of brushing some things under the rug and just getting overly involved with a chaotic work schedule. Chaotic, especially when I was in grad school. I was working 40 hours a week. I was going to school, you know, and I thought I had it all figured out. I was tired as hell, but I'm like, man, I know what I'm doing. We're going to be a psychologist, right? Making decent money at work. But there was a lot of things that weren't going, they were going unaddressed, you know, and those things eventually will come out of the woodwork. You can only push things down for so far or for so long.
It really speaks to the importance of, I mean, living a balanced life, trying to find some balance, which is can be elusive.
Yeah,
it can be elusive. Absolutely.
I went from making, you know, for me to be 27 years old, if anybody knows me in my life, making, you know, $85,000-$86,000 a year at a job and changing careers and then making, I don't even know how I got by for a couple of years. I mean, it was rough, you know, and it's still rough sometimes, but it was really rough for a period of time. I can't tell you that I felt any better or worse. I can't tell you my lifestyle changed dramatically when I made less money. I have been just as happy with $20,000 if I had with $85,000.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. I mean, there's a little bit less stress. I worried less financially, but of all that worrying I did when I didn't have any the financial security, nothing devastating ever happened to me.
That's right. I think that maybe people confuse that need for security with happiness. I mean, at a certain point, you know, you're stressing on bills and everything, mm-hmm. and if you can't make that money, that really impedes the happiness you have in your life. But after that point, you know, it's it doesn't make much of a difference.
But don't get me wrong. If I won the lottery right now, I'd be one happy guy.
Yeah.
I would have a lot
How
less stress.
Would you be charged? You'd be high off of it. I mean, you'd be really stoked.
I'd be pumped. Yeah.
How would you?
I would get out of this neighborhood. I would. Yeah. I could invest in businesses and online. You could do whatever you want to. So I think to a point.
Yeah.
It would enhance your life.
Sure. And I've heard about research on this, that there's kind of a point at which, you know, beyond basic means, money doesn't really add to happiness anymore. It can accentuate happiness. Like if you were a furniture maker, let's say, and you've been making furniture your whole life, you love making furniture, and now you have the money to buy the best tools to make furniture.
Right.
Well, that can add to your happiness. But if you just are some schmuck, or just some guy, let's say, not to be so harsh, you're just some guy, and you say, like, I got all this money, I want to make furniture, and you go out and you buy the best tools for making furniture. It's really not the tools themselves. It's just adding to this thing that already brings you pleasure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, you know, starting this podcast for me has added I'm not making any money off of this.
Right.
Yes. If anybody wants to advertise, we are accepting advertisers currently, and we're also accepting listeners. So, you know, but just me sitting down, getting us together, you know, going through to make sure the program's running correctly, posting it. Man, I haven't felt that good in a while. I was literally glowing when I posted this first podcast online, and I knew probably nobody was going to listen to it. And if they did, they probably listened to the first 5 minutes and then clicked off of it.
Right.
I didn't even care, you know, and there's no financial gain there. So I think that, you know, it's not a black or white issue. It's
right.
not always, you know, about money or what you're doing. It's a balance of both. Of course, if I just quit my job, I couldn't just be doing this all day long. I'd make no money and I'd be living on the streets, you know, but
that would be an imbalance.
That's imbalance.
Right. Yeah.
Definitely.
So let me ask you, like, how do you define happiness, or like, what do you think about happiness?
Oh, happiness. That's a good question. I think that, and I get sick of people saying, I just want to be happy.
Yeah.
Or just sometimes seeing happy people makes me angry. It really does.
Are you in a good mood when you see them?
I don't know. I just, sometimes well, the thing about happiness is it's an elusive thing. It's, what does it mean to be happy? There's been a lot written about that topic.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly. I don't think that happiness is something that you are to possess.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a level of acceptance. I think you can even replace acceptance with the term happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you and I, anybody out there, you go through cycles. You feel sad. You feel depressed. You feel joyful. You feel, maybe you're grieving something. Whatever the situation might be. The more you push away then the uncomfortable feeling. Some people are uncomfortable being happy.
Mm-hmm.
Those people who, I know people like that. I'm even like that sometimes. You mm-hmm. know, something good happens to me, and my reaction is usually very monotone. Something like, yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Mm.
You know?
Interesting. Yeah.
Oh, you got your master's degree, Ryan? Oh, yeah. I did. That's really great. I'm really excited about that. You know, but the point is that I'm very happy.
Yeah.
It's an acceptance that, so to the other point, when negative things do happen, if I can accept being uncomfortable and I can really be present for what's happening, I know this sounds like a bunch of, you know, new age BS, but it's a true story. That's really living my life. If I'm always pursuing happiness,
right.
If I'm always pursuing another line of cocaine, if I'm always pursuing, another relationship, if I'm always pursuing something else, what does that right. sound like to you? It sounds, again, like an addictive behavior almost.
Right.
I think people get addicted to happiness. I mean, there's multi-billion-dollar industry, self-help, which is perpetually telling people you aren't quite good enough where you're at.
Right.
You need to improve this. And once you figure out this key, these four steps to blah, 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 mm-hmm. then you're gonna be good to go. And you read that book and you know what? You're like, fuck, it didn't work. What is wrong with me? Mm-hmm. I need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Maybe we're just all inherently flawed.
Right.
Maybe that's just how it is. Maybe being happy is me saying, yeah, wow, this really feels uncomfortable. This is what this feels like. Yeah. This is what it feels like to get stabbed in the heart, for example. Wow, that's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. All right, let me just experience this for a second.
Right.
You know, when you come out of that and you gain that knowledge of you gain kind of that wisdom of what it's like to go through that, I think that is when you kind of see the joy in life, so to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, like, part of what I'm hearing you say, like, really, you didn't quite say it, but I mean, it's a lot about being in the moment, not being about, you know, using things to create some future for yourself, but experiencing what's happening, even if that is something that's mm-hmm. uncomfortable, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And the world's chaotic. Shit happens all the time. I mean, bad things happen. Painful things are going to happen. You can't avoid it.
Absolutely. So it's an unrealistic expectation for somebody to be able to sustain this joyous state that they may call happiness.
It's impossible to sustain it. You know, myself being an alcoholic and a recovering drug addict, you know, I'm an expert in trying to maintain that good feeling for a long period of time. And I would go to extremes in order to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work. You know what I mean? The more you grasp onto something, the more you likely are to harm it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're more likely just to harm you. Mm-hmm. Really, in life in general. I mean, I think
the
more attached you are to attaining something,
right.
The more you grasp at things, mm-hmm. right? And say, this is mine, I need to have this. The opposite of that is just kind of doing a dance with it almost. You know what I mean? Wow, these things are keep coming at me in my life. What if I just look at them? What if I just kind of play around with it and be curious? Be curious about it. Be a little scientist every day.
Right, right. Yeah, okay. I guess I think about happiness as something that's subjective. I mean, we all have, the way happiness is portrayed is a big fat smile and being in a joyous state. You know, I think that's the main conception of it, but how we actually feel inside or what you would call happiness, I think is a little different for everybody. I think it's for sure the absence, you know, it exists in the absence of like mental anguish. You know what I mean? Someone who's depressed probably won't say that they're happy.
So you're saying in the absence, as long as there's no pain, you can experience happiness.
It can be a variety of, yeah, exactly. I mean, at least I will definitely say that that's how I experience happiness.
Because mm-hmm.
happiness can be joy. Happiness can also just be contentment with the moment. It's not an intense joyousness, but it's just like everything's okay right now.
Even in the face of bad things, are you saying? Like, can you face a death of somebody close, but still feel a sense of openness with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that depends.
That's a very extreme case.
It depends a lot on a person's perception of that situation. Absolutely. If I sit down and I'm thinking about the loss of that person or whatever loss that is.
Any loss at all.
Any loss. And I'm saying, you know, this is unacceptable, mm-hmm. you know, how am I going to do this without this person or, you know, the world's not fair for them going, which are a lot of thoughts that anybody would have, and I would probably have too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be less likely to accept that, you know. And if I, you know, eventually if I get to the point where I think, you know, I realize the fact that we all have to die and I have to die too, and life isn't fair, mm-hmm. you know, but this is the way life is, and I'm still okay, and I'm still here, and fortunately I still get to experience life. I'm lucky enough for that. I'll feel more gratitude. I'll feel more contentment, you know, with the situation. I would call that happiness, definitely.
Do you feel yourself waiting for it to happen one day? Or is that the practice?
It's definitely a practice. I mean, when I'm in, you know, when I'm...
Like when you're a computer scientist, you're going to be happy when you're a computer scientist.
Exactly, right. When I'm not my best self, I guess you could say, and I'm putting off that happiness, I'm using things as a means to achieve happiness, like you were kind of describing before, then No, I'm not. You know, I'm anxious because I haven't gotten there yet. And will this get me there?
Yeah.
Is this the right thing to get me there? Or have I invested my time and energy in the wrong thing and I'll be thwarted again from achieving that, you know, holy grail?
Isn't it always temporary, though? I mean, isn't, you know, your money in your bank account is temporary? It's going to go away eventually.
Right.
Your
life itself.
Your job. Yeah. You know, your career path, relationships with anybody in your family or intimate partners.
Your health.
Your health. Everything's always temporary.
Yeah, your glass of water. I mean, it's anything, man. It's everything is absolutely temporary. So it, you know, it does go back to trying your best.
So do you think depression is a result of this struggle to always live up to this sort of unrealistic standard?
Depression, as simply as I could put it, I would say that depression is, having some unrealistic expectations for yourself or the world.
Yeah.
Having kind of a basic misunderstanding about how things are, how reality works. I think that there are people that really have a true, you know, chemical imbalance. And from what I understand and, the research that I've seen, people are born with a baseline for affect, right? Some people are lucky enough where they're born, their baseline for happiness is much higher. They just tend to reside on this more joyous, content level.
Is that a matter of resilience or is that just an innate property?
That's an innate property from what they can tell. Some people are just tend to have, they have baselines. Right. And I don't know if it's hereditary or genetic or whatever, or maybe it happens in the first couple years. Who knows? But by the time you're an adult, you seem to have a baseline for affect. And so some people are more happy-go-lucky. Some people are a little more on the sad side. Mm-hmm. You know, you can work to, increase your happiness and increase your positive affect by putting certain things into practice, like really working on your thoughts, what you're telling yourself.
Yeah.
But your baseline's going to stay the same. So I think, you know, I don't want to discredit the fact that, you know, some of us just tend to be a little sadder, and it's not necessarily your fault that you're sad, you know. I think it's your responsibility, if you do find yourself in a really depressed place, to, you know, work at it and to try to improve the state you're in.
So were you? That makes sense. So you're saying there is a personal responsibility, either on a medically supervised level or just on a lifestyle level.
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that the world is responsible for your emotional state. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nobody else's fault for how you feel, and it's not your fault for how you feel either.
Right.
For getting better, I think it's your responsibility. I look at it as a personal responsibility. Sometimes people are in such a place where they cannot help themselves.
Yeah.
And, we're lucky enough to have people in our support systems, like friends and family, that can come to our side and help us when we need to, such as somebody that's really despondently depressed. I mean, intensely depressed. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's hard to hurt yourself, please.
There seems to be a misunderstanding.
Hard to help yourself. Hard to help me, yeah.
There seems to be a misunderstanding that I see play out a lot, and that has to do with understanding what depression is. There seems to be a pervasive feeling that sadness, depression is sadness, and you should snap out of it. But if anybody's ever been depressed, truly depressed, telling somebody, and that you might have heard this before, telling somebody with depression to just get over it or it's going to get better or keep your head up is literally the same thing as telling somebody with cancer or another, you know, life-ending disease just to get better.
Just stop it.
Just keep your head up and get better. It's the same thing.
You have cancer? Stop it.
I mean, when you think about it, exactly, when you think about it, depression is the one illness, right? And it's an epidemic around the world, in this country especially. As far as, I don't know about what's going on around the world because I'm not that smart when it comes to that stuff, right? But in this country, it is It's an epidemic, and it's the only disease. And you get cancer, you break your leg, you have a will to get better. I'm going to get through this thing.
Right.
I'm going to get through this thing. If somebody truly is depressed and not sad, they lose that basic human survival instinct. It goes away. And so you're drawing to draw strength from a well that's completely empty.
That can't be, the seriousness of that cannot be understated enough or underscored enough. You're talking about hopelessness,
mm-hmm.
which is, I mean, like one of the real ingredients to getting toward a suicidal place.
Yeah.
And so the seriousness of being in that spot, like, yeah, I just wanted to underscore that because I think that can be glossed over really easily. And if you haven't experienced it yourself.
You're lucky, first of all.
Yeah. You're lucky, first yeah. of all. And you're a little, unfortunately, you're not quite in touch with what that experience really feels like. When we were preparing for the podcast today, we talked about possibly, you know, bringing up Robin Williams and discussing that a little bit. It looks like we're heading in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the notes I jotted down was just about hopelessness. And I've been depressed. I've experienced major depressive episodes in my life. And it was truly scary. I mean, the real turning point in one of those major depressive episodes was hopelessness. I mean, I remember waking up one morning and, just not really seeing a way for things to get better, not believing that things would get better, and just having this passive thought that it wouldn't be so bad if I wasn't here,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was the first real suicidal ideation I'd ever experienced in my life.
Yeah.
And luckily, I had already, went to school for psychology. I'd done my undergrad at that point, and I knew I had enough awareness around that subject to realize that, like, oh, I'm becoming suicidal. And, I went out and...
Did that help you being educated on it, or did that help, or was that still...
I could have used it to beat myself up. I mean, I could have said to myself, and at times maybe I had, that, I should know better. Because I have this degree in psychology. I didn't go there too much. Really, to me, it was more of a red flag than I used it for prevention, to not let myself get too far down into that dark place. And really, I can't describe it any better than a dark place. It felt like emptiness and darkness. It really felt like it was creeping into my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the scariest thing that I could think of, really.
How long did it last for?
That hopeless kind of feeling, that episode entirely.
Yeah, just that. And in general, how long do you usually find that it lasts for?
Oh man, I mean, I dipped in and out of that for like a week or two,
mm-hmm.
And really it was, I think that was kind of the climax where I woke up that morning and had those thoughts and realized that I was becoming suicidal.
Yeah.
I know I had not created a plan. Or anything like that. I didn't get that far.
Uh-huh.
But
as far as a plan to kill yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. As far as, a plan to hurt myself. And but that was enough for me. I mean, I knew where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, I guess I still had enough hope,
You got through it, yeah.
to pull myself out of it. And it wasn't completely me pulling myself. Let me also say that. It took a long time to get better. I mean, it took me months to start feeling better,
mm-hmm.
really, and start feeling like I really had some control in my life, and I felt like I could feel better on, day to day.
Yeah.
And I went to my therapist, and I did use medication for a brief amount of time,
mm-hmm.
To get out of that really low place.
And just to be clear, you were on medication, but also you were in therapy at the same time.
Exactly.
And I think that's a big thing that. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are in prescription psychotropic medications, but I know they're through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And what percentage of people have been on those things for 20, 30, 40 years?
Oof.
And they're really meant, if anybody is listening, they're really meant to be supplemented with some sort of lifestyle change, some sort of cognitive change, some sort
right.
of new connections in your brain or relationship to yourself.
Absolutely. I while I was doing the master's program with Ryan, I ran a depression therapy group with another therapist there. We did that for about a year, and that was one of the pieces of research that we'd remind the group members of was that medication works best in conjunction with therapy.
Absolutely. The numbers are actually staggeringly high, the effectiveness of that versus one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. So, and that was a major fear of mine as well, because I'd known other people who had started using medication and couldn't get off of it. And I didn't want to become dependent on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I already had a hard enough time feeling okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to become dependent on this thing to feel okay, well, and make it harder for myself.
That's true. You know? Sometimes getting help, whether it be medication or whether it be a therapist, almost makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it feel like, man, I can't even get over this myself. I need help. I need assistance. What is wrong with me? And then these shame-based feelings start coming in for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think you probably hear it more in men than women, mm-hmm. because we're kind of conditioned to not acknowledge those things.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I know of somebody who recently had a trauma involving a violent act, and they were almost shot. Their house was broken into, and they were almost shot.
Wow.
And I remember seeing this gentleman's Facebook post. You know, he's saying, I can't sleep at night, I'm up all night. So he was hypervigilant.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And can't sleep. So hypervigilant, you think of what? PTSD,
mm-hmm.
right? And him saying, I'm not going to go see no shrink. I got, you know, my family and my friends here. And I'm thinking, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's people who are actually trained to understand the actual physiological changes that happen in your brain after undergoing a trauma, for example. The point is, go talk to somebody. It doesn't make it worse. Don't beat yourself up because you can't get over shit yourself.
Right.
Not many people can get through life doing anything by themselves.
Right.
Right. You need friends. You need some sort of support system, mm-hmm. you know. I actually brought up some numbers here. 1 in 10 Americans are depressed. 80%, so 1 in 10 are depressed. 80% of those go undiagnosed. Right. Mm-hmm. And what made me think about that is you had talked about thoughts of suicide before.
Right.
And, you know, I've had the thought of killing myself many times.
Mm-hmm.
I've played around with the idea of it. I've never killed myself, obviously.
Right.
I'm still here doing this. Thank God. But the point is those thoughts are in no way at all unusual or make you weird or out of the norm.
Great
point. I think that's very important for people to understand, is just because you have that thought, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It's just a nature of understanding that you exist in the world, and what would it be like not to exist anymore, not to experience any of this, you know,
mm-hmm.
to go to sleep and not wake up again? What is that? I mean, that's a question that everybody should ask themselves, if you ask me.
Sure.
You know, I think that can, you know, drive your life forward. But the point is, you know, not to be ashamed of things that come up in your head. They're there for a reason,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're not hurting anybody.
Absolutely. It's a great point. I looked at, and that's how I would frame it with people I would talk to, is that it's, if you're having suicidal thoughts, it's because you're severely depressed. It's a natural, I mean, that's where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
That's the progression of depression. When you get to that point, you start having those thoughts, and that makes you normal. You know, that's a typical evolution
yeah.
of depression.
Absolutely.
When you become severely depressed, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just such a shame. I mean, there's just so much shame involved with depression. It's like you take anything
yeah.
as a reason to be. I mean, even having the thoughts, the fact that you're depressed in and of itself, you know, it feels shameful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, you know, Robin Williams, and I want to kind of tie this into Robin Williams because that just happened recently.
Mm-hmm.
I had talked to a client of mine, a personal training client, and they're going on and on about, oh, how could his wife and blah, blah, blah not know that he was going to kill himself? You know,
right.
obviously would know if somebody was so depressed. And so this came up a couple times, and what I shared with them was, listen, when somebody is so, so depressed, where they're at the depths of their depression, they might be thinking about killing themselves. They certainly don't have the energy. They don't have the enough energy to go to the brain cycles that would require to actually kill themselves. The physical energy just isn't there. The mental processes can't happen. It's not until somebody starts coming out of the hole And some of you might be like, wow, this person is doing really great. Mm-hmm. Wow, they're really thriving. No, that person is more likely to kill themselves after they get out of that low point of the depression.
Why is that? I mean,
because all of a sudden they have the energy to do it. Mm-hmm. They can think more clearly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're still depressed, but they're just not in the bottom parts of it. And I can't think of a good metaphor for what that would be like, but I think that's important to understand too, is that just because you're not feeling depressed anymore doesn't mean you're completely out of the woods.
That's a really,
because it can go away and it can even come back too, mm-hmm. just like that. But yeah.
And that's part of, I think that plays into chronic depression as well. When somebody has multiple major depressive episodes over their life, mm-hmm. you know, I think it can be easier to achieve that hopeless state. You know what I mean? That things won't get better. Oh, I'm coming out of my depression now, but I'm just going to go back later.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's a scary proposition to go back to that.
The biggest risk for suicide is people who have already tried to kill themselves, right? Because the one inhibitor of people killing themselves is the pain associated with that. So somebody who has attempted suicide already experienced the physical, mental pain of that. They understand they can now handle it.
Wow.
So the next time around, all of a sudden the risk factor for them to kill themselves goes way up because they know they can deal with the physical pain of death.
They've practiced, in a sense.
Basically, almost. Yeah. They've practiced and they're more confident in themselves, I guess you could say.
Yeah. It's not as scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering and I know you've dabbled in comedy a little bit. It's kind of your thing. You enjoy it.
Sure.
How can a guy like Robin Williams, I mean, have you ever seen Robin Williams do stand-up comedy?
Well, on video, like on TV.
Yeah, I mean, sure. That guy has got the most amazing energy I've ever seen of any person on stage as far as individual performances go. I mean, some of that might have been, he might have had some help with some drugs along
possibly,
the way, but whatever. I mean, if you ever listen to stories about him too, he's always this really upbeat, kind person.
And he's just his mental acuity is outstanding. Like the way he takes on several characters and jumps between the characters.
Flawlessly.
And creates a narrative and makes it hilarious.
You might be able to touch on this, but how can somebody, and this is a good metaphor or a good comparison, that people who seem happy all the time on the outside, uh-huh. they go to work, they're always cheery, they're always helping out their people, but they're also depressed. A comedian, you know, where does comedy and kind of this sadness, depression come into play? Like, is there a lot of comedians who you think have a dark side and are more open to it, have experienced more?
I think that that's like the stereotype of a comedian.
Oh, is this? Okay,
yeah, like
okay.
It having kind of being a little bit tormented. Or like, it reminds me of those theater faces, like one of them smiling and one of them's crying,
yeah.
right? Like the clown that cries. Or, you know, I think that there have been a handful of comedians that have suffered with manic depression, and pretty successful ones like Steve Martin, I think, wrote a book about how he experienced depression and everything. And, you know, part of that manic side, I think, mm-hmm. propels them professionally.
Definitely.
You know, because when you are manic, I mean, you are Mr. Personality. You know what I mean? And you are fun to be around. And you have endless amounts of energy and all these ideas and the confidence to go out and do it.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if when you go that high up, you got to come down, you know. And I will say also, there's all kinds of pitfalls. I mean, you can use comedy. You know, you go up and you have this amazing time. Like, you go up and you perform in front of people, and it's so scary, and you do well, and then it feels so good.
But
you
you're
get
the guy.
This charge.
And you're the guy. Like, you have control over this mass of people, or however many people are there.
Yeah, you're the man. I mean, you won. You know what I mean? And it's this great moment, I guess. And and you get a charge off of it. I mean, that's a high.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And when you go back next week and it's a different crowd and you're not as comfortable with your material, or you lost touch with it or whatever, and you just get a different reaction. That can definitely bum you out, man. And if you don't have, you know, the right perception and, you know, resolve to deal with that, you can use that to bum yourself out, definitely. You can also use it to motivate yourself to do better. Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Rogan is obviously a famous comedian. He talks about that. There's certain times where he's done really poorly on stage, and it's, you know, pushed him to do better.
To do better.
I also think that, and eventually I want to talk about this on the podcast. I don't have a lot to say about it right now, but there's absolutely a therapeutic aspect to performing stand-up comedy.
I remember talking to you about this one time.
Yeah.
We were going to see Louis C.K.
Right.
In the city, and you were talking about how can I incorporate comedy into therapy.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's certain... we talked about earlier about acceptance and how acceptance plays a role in happiness. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's part of your understanding of happiness. And I would definitely agree with that. And part of joke writing, I mean, to take a joke and write it and perform it and really own it, you've got to accept that material. You got to accept the ideas in that bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And some of the best comedy is vulnerable. People are talking about stuff in their lives that you couldn't broach that subject otherwise. You know,
who's a good example of that nowadays that you look up to?
Oh man, Marc Maron is one of the, you know, he pretty much primarily talks about stuff that's bugging him, and
Marc Maron makes me depressed when I listen to him.
Really?
He
okay.
Just, I'll listen to that guy, I'm like, what am I? I should just give up because this is what I got to look forward to.
Well, okay, he airs his stuff. I'm not sure who really...
He's very pessimistic, though. He's
overly
pessimistic.
You know, who's the most shining example of this is a lady named Tig Nagera.
Yeah.
Who, Louis C.K. actually kind of exposed her to the world. She, this is a lady who got diagnosed with cancer.
Okay.
And she's a working comedian. I guess she's out in New York or something. And she gets diagnosed with breast cancer. Freaks out about it over a couple of days, and then throws together these ideas about, you know, bringing this to the stage. You can actually download this exact set on iTunes, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's an amazing set. She goes up there and she takes this issue of her having cancer and she puts it out there, and she kind of rides this line between depressing everybody and making them laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give it away, but she kind of puts it out there like...
What's her name again?
Tig Nagera.
Oh, I've heard of her. I've heard of her.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she, if you typed in, you know,
Google.
Breast cancer comedian woman, you'd
okay.
probably find her immediately. I think it's T-I-G is her first name, the way
okay.
it's spelled. So she goes out there and she's like, I have cancer. And everybody's like, no, no. She's like, no, it's okay, it's okay. I have cancer. And I don't know how to describe it, but she makes it seem she's accepted it in herself.
Yeah.
And everybody else kind of comes there with her, and she's talked about how it's helped her deal with I don't know, the experience of having cancer. And since she's had a mastectomy, she's living, she's okay.
Yeah.
From what I understand, but yeah. That's a good example of a comedian who took something that's really difficult and brought it on stage and found some acceptance in herself. Through, you know, joke writing, through comedy.
Which you also find it through the commonality of everybody. I mean, everybody's experiencing these things. Like Louis C.K. is a guy that, you know, everybody knows Louis C.K., but, man, he talks about, the way he talks about things, I'm like, oh, yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know? And it's a little taboo, maybe.
Exactly.
But I totally identify with it, but I'm not going to, I can't vocalize it the way he does.
Thank you. So he's taken something that's otherwise unacceptable in normal life.
Yeah.
He's just said it in front of everybody.
Yeah.
In a funny way. Now we can all accept it. He's modeled how to feel about this thing that we're all experiencing.
Yeah.
And that it's okay and it's actually funny. Now we're relieved. We can feel good, okay about it too. We can laugh at it.
Exactly.
You know, I think it is therapeutic in a lot of ways.
I totally want to imitate some Louis C.K. jokes, but that would be doing him a great disservice.
Great disservice.
So
yeah.
I'll let you see him. You guys just go watch him on YouTube.
Just go download
if you listen to me tell his jokes, you're going to think he's an awful comedian. So was that have to do more with your idea about the comedy and the therapy? Is there more? Have you thought? Is there more to it than how you would integrate the two?
Yeah, I think.
Or how somebody might be able to start thinking about this on their own, even.
I think. Absolutely. I think that No, you know, I don't know. I would like to work this in clinically somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure exactly yet how to work with somebody that is really in a tough spot, and to convince them to write jokes about it.
Yeah. But how empowering, though.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
I did a similar thing one time, a long time ago. I remember, when I say a long time ago, I mean a couple of years ago, maybe. I was going, you know, I've struggled chronically with depression and anxiety throughout the course of my life. And one time I actually wrote a dialogue in a journal. And a dialogue was me being, like, I was acting like a bully towards the depression. I was writing this down like, hey, you son of a bitch, I'm going to kick your fucking ass.
Right.
You better shut the fuck up, you dumb motherfucker. All right, so it was basically along those lines.
Right.
And I felt great.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like me just saying, you know what, I'm going to, you're my bitch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Essentially, whatever you want to say.
Okay.
But it was extremely empowering.
Yeah.
It was really empowering. And it separated that depression from myself. It made it to be this other thing that was just annoying. And it was like that, just, you know, a kid in middle school that you can't stand being around, like, mm-hmm. type of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
That sounds a lot like narrative therapy, kind of.
It is, yeah. That's very similar to narrative therapy.
Yeah, you kind of, you don't identify with your problem. You make it something kind of outside yourself.
Yeah.
And, you basically take it on, in a sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I did just lose a thought that was actually pretty... Well, okay, so that sounds like...
That's a sign of depression, I think, is losing thoughts.
It does, yeah, losing, not being...
not being able to remember things, loss of memory.
What'd you just say? So that's one side of it. I mean, if you were to take it on and just let go and yell at your depression, I think that has comedic value in it, absolutely. And I guess what I was thinking more along the lines of taking whatever issue that you find is bugging you, you know, like your girlfriend left you, mm-hmm. and maybe you have some ideas about yourself, about why your girlfriend left you.
Yeah.
You know, let's look at some of those ideas about yourself. Are some of them true? Are they actually objectively true?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there a good case to put forth that they are true? If you think that they're true, if we found that, yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe I'm not like, you know, whatever. I'm not like that smart or that quick or whatever it is.
Right.
Let's write some jokes about how you're not smart.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's get some of that down on paper. Let's laugh about it. You know?
I can
see it. You know, if you go out and you perform some of this stuff and people laugh about it, I think it's a little easier to accept in yourself, you know, if other people accept it as well.
Yeah.
You
can even make, even if you can make light of it yourself a little bit.
Right.
You know, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to take it on stage necessarily, but.
I could also see it being really inappropriate for some people, you know what I mean, to suggest this to them. I guess
you could guide them through the process so they won't. Maybe even know what they're doing. You could say, let's write about this, and I don't know. I guess that's kind of the X factor of trying to decide how you would make this work.
Exactly.
Or could make it work.
It's a raw idea right now, and I need to figure out how I want to approach it.
That's interesting.
It's got some power to it, though. It's got potential, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming up in about, what, an hour right now?
That's phenomenal. Yeah, we
do you want to keep going, or we should? I think it's probably a good time to wind down.
I definitely feel a lull. Yeah, let's do it.
So if anybody is still listening right now, thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Round of applause for you. That's awesome. It's been good. I was actually going to put my email out there. If you guys have any questions about anything we talked about today, I would love to be able to address some questions online.
That's a great idea.
So my email address, and I'll try to post it when I post this online, is Ryan, R-Y-A-N, dot Witkowski, W-I-T-K-O-W-S-K-I, at M-E, that's me.com. So Ryan.Witkowski at me.com. Feel free to shoot an email. And if you actually, again, if you shoot me an email, that means you listened to how many minutes of this podcast?
49.
49 minutes, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you
absolutely.
Very much.
Hey, even if you don't have a question, just let us know
listening. Yeah, exactly.
Shoot us an email.
Shoot us an email. It'll make us feel good about ourselves. I guess we'll wind it up. We're going to try to do weekly podcasts, I think. probably a Wednesday, and I'm not sure when they'll be. We'll try to get them out by now that we actually know how to get upload them. I'll try to get them out by the end of the week. It doesn't take that long.
That's right. Yeah, and we got I think we're gonna have some guests coming up too.
That's a good point. We have some ideas for guests. We don't really want to say them right now, but there are some other colleagues we have in the mental health care industry, the fitness industry. A couple people who I know who are really into integral psychology, which is a whole another beast in itself.
And if any of you are listening out there and you might want to participate in the podcast and you think you have something really interesting
sure.
you want to talk about, shoot us an email.
Definitely. It's just us sitting around and talking, you know.
Yeah.
And no, we're not talking anymore. So that's going to be the end of it.
So that's a non-podcast. Thank you, everybody, very much for listening. Unsolicited advice, the blog.
The blog is Ryan's Unsolicited Advice.blogspot.com. You can probably Google unsolicitedadvice.com. I haven't shelled forth $18,000 yet for the actual URL.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. That'll get there.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right, guys. Take care.